Bob, an alcoholic. I'm going to sit through this one. I was standing, my back was starting to get a little squirmy. I'm standing all day. There's a lot of questions here. Now, I haven't looked through any of them. So I don't have answers. But I might have experience. And if I have experience, I'd be glad to share it with you. It doesn't mean it's right. You know, one of the beauties of Alcoholics Anonymous is that through our common experiences and listening to the experience of others, you lead me to a consciousness that is already within me but hidden from me. You lead me to myself. Your answers are already in you. And if my experience helps you to uncover any of that or find that within yourself, that's great. I think that's how AA works often. That and a mean sponsor can do wonders for your recovery. Okay, I'm going to go through these and then we'll talk about singleness of purpose a little bit. Is it more effective to provide a rigid framework for a sponsee or be positively open, receptive to requests for help as the sponsee wants it? There's just something. I mean, doesn't it seem something like there's something wrong with a person asking for help, directing the help? Yeah. Right? That just ain't right. I mean, if you can direct your own recovery, what are you calling me for? There's only one element within me that would ever presume to know anything, and that's my ego. My spirit doesn't presume anything. It just is. It's the chatter of I know or I'm. I'll tell you something. I like structure. It's funny. Here's the kind of guy I am. I rebel at it initially because my ego hates restriction. It hates being curtailed. It hates being tethered to anything. But yet, when I surrender to the structure of Alcoholics Anonymous, and that's showing up early for my home group and making my commitments and calling my sponsor and being transparent, even telling him that stuff and asking him what I should do even when I don't want him to know what I just did. But when I do that and I live within that structure, I am safe and protected, and I am facilitating an existence that allows God's grace. My friend Bob from St. Paul says all the time, he says that a farmer doesn't grow, he creates an environment in which God can grow. And I think that's what Alcoholics Anonymous and sponsorship and commitments and everything we do here, the structure of this puts us safe and protected in a zone where God can have his way with us. I think that's what we do here. I'm big for structure. I understand when people rebel about it, against it. I understand. I'm that guy. I don't want anybody telling me what to do. I'm the smartest one in the room here. Right? I get it. I mean, I get it. That's the guy I brought here. I get that. But I can't survive that. Go without structure for a number of years in AA. Run your own ship. You'll want structure if you survive. How does one stay right-sized when they get so much attention at the podium? Should folks in the helping therapist profession still sponsor people? Okay, two different questions. The first question is a big piece of business in my life. This is very dangerous. Very dangerous. This has the capacity to feed something in me that should be starved. My sponsor won't let me stop doing it. But in order to do it, I have to maintain a level of action and outside the and away from the podiums in my life. I go into the trenches regularly. I sponsor a lot of guys, and I listen to fifth steps, and I have like these. I'm a greeter. you come to my home group on Monday night, I'm one of the guys that's got a coat and tie on. I don't need to have a coat and tie on, but I don't know what else to do to show respect to A. I'm a coat and tie at the door, shaking hands and trying to make people feel welcome. I'm the guy Tuesday night that's setting up the chairs and doing the coffee. I'm the guy Tuesday afternoon and Wednesday night and Sunday night when I'm in town and Thursday night when I'm in town. It's taking a meeting into an institution. I could live very comfortably and be sober for the rest of my life and cut the speaking out, but I couldn't cut the rest out and just do the speaking. There are people that try to do that. Oh my God. I don't know. Maybe they're not cut from, maybe they're not the extreme example of self-will run riot that I brought here, because that would make me, I would fill so up with myself and oh my God, it'd be horrible. Second question, should folks in the therapist helping profession still sponsor people? If you got alcoholism, you got to sponsor people. I worked in that field for a while. When I first got sober this last time in 78, I went back into that field for about almost a year against my sponsor's wishes. And he kept saying, you shouldn't do that as a way, you shouldn't make money off of helping people. You got to do that for free. And he's old. What does he know? I can make more money doing this than I could washing dishes or doing something else. So I did it for a year, and I read an article in a magazine that said that of all the professions that a recovering alcoholic could get into, the one with the highest relapse rate was alcoholism counselor. Statistically, you have a better chance staying sober as a drug dealer than you do as an alcoholism counselor. And that sounds bizarre, doesn't it? Because you're working around it. You think, well, I don't understand. That doesn't make sense. Here's what happened to me and why my sponsor didn't want me to do it. What are the two most vital things in my own sobriety to keep me tethered into a place in AA where I can receive God's grace and work these steps? Well, one is remaining sponsorable. And the other one is to do service, 12-step work, and sponsor others. And after a couple months working in the field, I didn't want to go on 12-step calls anymore. And here's what I'd say to myself. And this comes from the voice that is my enemy. It says things to me like, well, for God's sakes, Bob, you do that all day. It's the same thing, isn't it? I told that to my sponsor. He says, no, you're getting paid for that. That is self-serving. Well, but I help people. He said, you have to do this for fun and for free. You want to work in that field? Go. You got to get off work and do 12-step work. You got to sponsor people. He said, if you listen to that, you're cutting off one of the main sources of grace in your life. And then the other one is I filled my head with all kinds of information and knowledge, and my ego loves information. It thinks it has power now. And I stopped being sponsorable because I became the I know guy, right? I mean, everybody's coming to ask me for professional opinions about stuff. Well, I must be one who has all knowledge. The spirit is often like a lake that you'll see up in the mountains. Up in the Rocky Mountains, I saw a lake that was so clear and the water was so pristine and clean, you could see the rocks at the bottom. That's how clear it was. And I looked around, and on one side of the lake there was a stream with water flowing in rapidly, and on the other side of the lake there was a stream with water going out. And consequently, the lake could never get stagnant because it flowed. You dam up either side of that and you will start to get stagnant. If I'm not sponsorable and getting direction from outside my head, and I am not diligently seeking out people to give it away to, what I've found here, my experience, I'm blocking both ends of that dam. And that's what I started to do when I was working in the field. Now, I'm not saying that's the experience of everyone. Maybe there are a few individuals that can successfully be two-hatters, but they remain humbly sponsorable, and they get off work, and they go to their home group, and they help with the chairs, and they go on 12-step work, and they go take meetings into different institutions than the ones they work in, and they stay active. They never grandize themselves as a superior member of AA. They stay part of the herd, and they follow the herd and take the actions of the herd. I understand why they say it's the most dangerous field for people like me. It has the potential to starve that which should be fed and feed that which should be starved. Probably more than anything. We have people now. I tell you, I get scared sometimes for the future of AA and what's happening to our public image. Our public relationship policy now is horrid because there's some examples out there of people representing AA doing some terrible things, and the public doesn't know the difference. You know, in California and in New York and San Francisco, there's these recovery coaches now. And for fees somewhere up to as high as $25,000 a month, they'll sponsor you if you're rich or a movie star or a rock star. I saw a price list of a guy at one time years ago I had a lot of respect for. He's a very charismatic guy. And $500 to take you to a meeting. So much for each phone call. $5,000 for the 12-step call. They don't call 12-step call, they call it an intervention. For him to come and talk to you. I think that is just as hideous a level of predator as the guy who trolls Alcoholics Anonymous for wounded new women to have sex with. Whether it's financial predator or sexual, you're a predator, still a predator. And I tell you, this is making us look bad to the rest of the world. There's movie stars out there, they don't even come to AA anymore because they get these recovery, they get their guy. They get their guy. I think that's a dangerous thing. See, I'm on a soapbox already. I'm not even that far into this. I'm in a soapbox already. I'm sorry. How do you know when to change sponsors? Well, if you smell whiskey on your sponsor's breath. If you come over to talk to him and he's got a belt around his arm, that's probably not a good sign either. If he stops doing AA, how can you be sponsored by someone who's not even going to meetings anymore? I know people that do that. I couldn't do that. I've had two sponsors in 35 years. The first sponsor I had for my first 15 years. And for the last 20, I have given him the respect of a sponsor, but I've gotten the last 20 years my direction from another person. And the reason I went and got the other person was that my first sponsor and I became so close. I mean, I love the guy. I still love him. I go over and take care of him. I'm the executor of his estate. We were in business together for a number of years. I mean, we got so close that what happens when you start to really love someone and they're like your best friend, you lose all objectivity with them. That's why you can't have your husband or your wife sponsor you, right? You can't have your brother or sister sponsor you. It's too close. We get help better from people who care, but it's a detached caring. When you can't detach enough to give directions. See, if it's your best friend, and what are you going to do if you have to tell them something that's going to hurt their feelings and they may not be your best friend anymore? See, then self-interest is involved, and it clouds the waters. So I got this other guy when I was 15 years sober because I Me and my sponsor were too close. I still respect him. I talk to him a lot. But I get my direction from a man who I know is very strong in principle. And he, not only is he willing to hurt my feelings, there have been times where I suspected he enjoyed hurting my feelings. That may not be true, but I don't know. But you don't quit sponsors because he's giving you direction you don't like. I think there's a covenant. Our ultimate authority here is a loving God. But I think there's a covenant, and the covenant is that when two or more of us come together for the purpose of recovery, he will be in the midst. And that's why sponsorship, it transcends. The whole, when my sponsor and I get together, the whole is greater than the sum of the parts. There's something else there. When we get together and forget ourselves for the mutual purpose of recovery. And if you sponsor people, you may have had this experience where you got a guy you sponsor and he's in trouble and you want to tell him something that would help and you have nothing. And a funny thing will happen out of the desire, which comes from the old English meaning of the Father, from the desire to help him. At times, it's as if a portal opens up inside of me somewhere and stuff starts coming out that is beyond me. I've had that happen to me where I'll be telling a guy something. I've never said this to anybody. I don't even know where it comes from. But it's right. It resonates in you in that you know that this is the right thing. It's coming out of you. I've had that experience to the point where I'd be telling some guy something and I'm listening to what I'm saying and I'm thinking, I should write this down. I think I'm going to need this. This is really amazing. And I've had the same thing with my sponsor. My sponsor gave me direction one time that was unbelievable. I asked him later, have you ever said that to anyone? And he said, it just occurred to me at the moment. It was perfect. I believe God was talking right through him. I believe that. God talks through me sometimes. I can't control that. My God, if you could control that, I'd go to a casino and get him to tell me what do to bet on. You know, I mean, I think when I try to help another person, sometimes something else comes into the midst. Sponsorship is very powerful. There's a dangerous, the ego, if you're egocentric and it's deceiving you, it will say things to you like this. Well, you don't need a sponsor. God's going to be your sponsor. It's going to be me and God. No human power. He can't manage his own life. Those are the ramblings and the chatter of an entity that wants to remain in charge. Right. Are there any specific medications or drugs that can turn on the craving for alcohol? I'm not a pharmacologist. I mean, I do talk to some, and I read a lot. Since this has become, medication has become very prevalent in AA, especially with new people coming in with a dual diagnosis, and we get they're just giving medication to everybody now. I mean, it's just, you're having a bad day, here, take this. I mean, it's like unbelievable. So I study everything I can. There's some brilliant psychiatrists that have done independent research on medications that's not paid for by the pharmaceutical companies. Most of the stuff the medical people get is research and case studies that's paid for by the pharmaceutical companies. I mean, do you think there's any chance that could be tainted a little bit? I mean, for God's sakes. I mean, if I had a chance to make $100 billion a year off some drug, I think I would tweak the evidence a little bit. I mean, I would. I mean, you know. So there's some people that are doing great research on some of this stuff. And I think, you know what, alcohol is a very immediate allergic reaction for the alcoholic. But there seems to be some experiential evidence from watching people, and also a little bit of my own experience, that there are other substances that, if you're alcoholic, are very, very dangerous. Silkworth says something. He says that we can't safely use alcohol in any form at all. What does that mean? Vodka, rum, beer, I'm sure. Wine, yeah, I'm sure. But does it mean anything else that lights us up? Because I suspect if it will do that for me, it will do that. It has the potential to do that to me. Now, maybe not everything. I know guys that get on some medications, and it's a phenomenon of craving, but it's subtle, and it's a slow burn, and it takes years. They'll get on, see, I had this on, my string was a little shorter. I was put on, in the years I was in and out, I saw some great psychiatrists, and I had symptoms that looked like clinical depression and symptoms that looked like panic disorder, and et cetera, et cetera. And I was given the appropriate medical treatment for that kind of stuff. And what would happen to me, and I'm not saying this is the case of everybody, this is my own experience, is that they would give me medication that after a few days would provide a little bit of relief from my emotions. And it was good. The problem is my very nature is such that the little bit of relief slowly over a long period of time becomes not enough. And I yearn for more relief. It's almost like a protracted, drawn out, slow burn of the phenomenon of craving. Instead of being immediate, it's like 8-10 months later, it's not, I gotta go get a drink or take something stronger or add something in the mix, or I have a little bit more. Now, I don't know if that's the experience of everybody. And I don't even know if that's the phenomenon of craving. I don't know. Maybe it's just that I'm taking this stuff as an alternative treatment instead of the steps for Alcoholics Anonymous, instead of devoting my life to helping others. And maybe what's really happening is that it's my untreated alcoholism that's the slow burn. I don't know. I just know, personally for me, I don't take anything. I have a healthy respect for this. I don't drink near beer. I don't take near cocaine. I don't eat food cooked with alcohol. I did when I first got sober because my sponsor said it was cooked off. And then I read this article, they did experiments. It's not cooked off. Once I read that, man, I never could eat. I tell you, I was lucky that how much does it take to set you off? I mean, if you really, truly, maybe you just intellectually placate the allergy. Maybe you don't really believe it. But if you really believed it, let's say you had an allergy to peanut oil. And you ingest any peanut oil into your system and you end up in the hospital and you may die. Respiratory arrest. Your lungs are closing up on you. You're dying. Would you cook with peanut oil? Would you see if you can find some near peanut oil? Would you try almond oil? If it killed you, or almost killed you one or two times, you'd be very, very respectful of that allergic reaction to peanut oil. I am very, very respectful for my allergic reaction to alcohol in any of its forms. I don't know. People can argue, say, this doesn't give you the phenomenon of craving. You want me to try it and find out? You want me to play the game of let's bet my life and 4 years later I'm back to drinking? I don't know. I'm gonna turn the volume up on my 12-step work and my step work. It's a safer bet for me. How important are my feelings in relationship to my purpose? Absolutely no importance at all. Thank you. Ha, ha, ha. I don't know what this says, but I like it because it has my name in it. It looks like, how fast has Bob gotten his something cylinder to dot, 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 dot? Whoever wrote this, did you steal my sex inventory? I don't know what it says. I'd like to answer, but I'm not sure what it says. If anybody wants to clarify what the question says, because I don't know what it says. Can an alcoholic of 50 years plus just quit, no recovery? Is it possible? If you're asking, do I think it's possible for an alcoholic to stay sober 50 years just on their own, just to quit? I think if you had acute alcoholism, that happens all the time. People quit for a lifetime just on the decision and a little support from their church or family. But if you have chronic alcoholism, I doubt that anybody can make it that long. I mean, it's possible. I guess we could adapt to extreme levels of depression and loneliness and angst, and I don't know. If you're like me, it's inconceivable that I could stay. It's inconceivable that I could stay sober a year without Alcoholics Anonymous, without some sort of transformation, without some sort of bondage of self-relieving actions. I don't think I could. I implode on myself. I get too full of myself. I get too wrapped up in myself, too obsessed and focused and worried about myself. I get too lonely, wrapped up in myself. It's very painful. There was a guy in Vegas that used to say something to the newcomers that was funny, but it was also true. He'd say, if you're new, he'd say, keep coming back. It hurts. It does. When the smoke clears of not drinking, it's emotionally starts to be very a little bit uncomfortable progressively. Well, just a chronic dissatisfaction. I don't know. I couldn't do it. What do you do for a living? I am the general manager of the universe. I retired. I own a bunch of real estate, income real estate, commercial stuff. I get a lot of income from that. But I retired, I don't know, a long time. I was 50 years old. I sold my company about 10, it's in over a decade now. And I won't even think I was 50. I might have been 49. I don't know. But I sold my company. Very successful. I ended up with a lot of material security, and I decided at that point, people were telling me I was too young to retire, and I thought, well, I'm going to try. And I'm busier than I was when I worked. I just my life is filled to the brim with useful service. It's amazing. I love it. I started writing again. I've written 4 TV shows, and none of them are on the air. I sure had fun writing them. And I actually have one. A producer in Hollywood wants to produce. I have to rewrite it, though. That's a whole other story. I think I'm afraid that it might be a success because I drag my feet doing what he asked me to do 3 months ago. You know, I think I'm scared. Truth be told. I don't know what I'm more afraid of, success or failure. Mm-hmm. I don't know. But I'm a singer-songwriter, and I write songs, and I do AA, and I made the decision when I sold my company that from now on, I'm just going to try to fill my life with things that light up my soul. That keep the light going. And everything I do in my life is to that end. I do a lot of service. I work with people. I do 12-step work. I sponsor guys. I love the guys I sponsor. They, even though at times they annoy the crap out of me, but I do love them. I really do. And I spend time with my daughter, and my life is very good. It's better than I deserve. I better keep helping people so I don't throw it away. And, part two, do you apply the 12 steps to your career? Absolutely. And even more importantly, the 12 traditions. Chamberlain was so adamant, he used to say this a lot, is you cannot compartmentalize your life. You can't be a spiritual giant in AA and a slimy business person. You can't be a good AA member and a guy who cheats on his wife. You can't do that. It's a delusion that you can compartmentalize your life and I can be good over here and bad over there. You can't. It bleeds in. It doesn't work like that. You just make yourself sick. And in chapter Into Action, it talks about that. It talks about more than most that we try to live a double life. And we can't do it. We can't do it. I must have integrity, which is oneness of purpose, mind, ethic, and conviction. I must be integral, one. I must be the same person at work than I am in AA, than I am with my daughter, than I am in traffic, than I am at the grocery store, than I am in the airport when my plane's been delayed. I travel a lot. Airports are great places to practice spiritual principles. One of my favorite writers had a saying. He said, last minute unplanned for changes in travel plans are dancing lessons from God. I have tangoed around some airports, let me tell you. And they really are. You get to see when you're threatened and scared and things aren't going your way and you're afraid, oh, I'm going to lose my bag, I'll be lost, stuck in the airport overnight. Now, how are you still going to act like a good member of AA? Are you going to be helpful to the other people that are scared? And there's a lot of opportunities to be helpful in travel. I tell the guys I sponsor, listen, you got to be the same guy everywhere. So if you're an idiot, be an idiot everywhere. Be an idiot, but be the same guy. Be the same guy. And life will rub the sharp edges off you if you're the same guy everywhere. Another guy used to say, in my home group, he used to say, you can do anything you want sober as long as you can stand up in front of your home group and talk about it. That eliminates a lot. Don Pritz used to say, whenever you go to do something, pause and say to God, would you go with me on this? Some things God wouldn't go. You just know that, don't you? You're going to go cheat on your wife. God ain't going. You're on your own. You're going to help somebody? Oh, he's in the car with you. Yeah. How do you... How do you push... Sure. Going into year 27, do all A's have... Oh, going into year 2, and then a question mark, not 27, 2, question mark. Do all A's have terrible 2s? Well, I don't know. We do know something that seems to be evident from most of our experiences. It could be 2, it could be 5, it could be 3. But you come in here, you're surrendered by the bottle. You're humbled by it. You burnt your life to the ground. You're humbled by that. And then in our abstinence, we have the second surrender as the ego comes back and we're in charge again and we start creating problems in our lives. And we're surrendered eventually in our abstinence by life itself. They used to talk about that back in the 70s a lot, about the second surrender. Surrendered by the bottle and then surrendered by life in abstinence. I don't know if that happens to people all in 2 years. 2 years is, that's a good shot. It takes my ego 2 years to kind of see what's going on so it can start maneuvering again. You know what I mean? It's not gonna come, because you've gotten a lot of attention for your humility when you renew. So you got to maintain the bragging rights of the humble and still run the universe at the same time. That's an art form. That's really, I mean, you got to kind of ease into this. You can't just jump right in there and start running the show. You got to kind of ease into it. You know? How soon, or is there a time that all 12 steps should be worked? 6 months, 1 year, ? Well, it's not a matter, there's no chronological meter for this. It is based on the individual's desperation and willingness. Some of you may have heard a guy speak. He would speak every weekend, but his wife won't let him. He speaks a lot, though. His name's Sheldon Fetty. He's got a British accent. I sponsor him. He's 18 years sober. And he was, before he turned 60 days sober, he was halfway through his 8-step list. And he did a good job. I got other guys, at 2 years sober, I'm going, have you finished your inventory yet? You know what I mean? Right? But it's my job to keep nudging them. And in the meantime, keep them in an environment that will protect them from them, with service commitments and a meeting habit, prayer. You know, you keep them entrenched in unity and service, and eventually they will get the recovery legacy. Eventually, because abstinence without all three hurts too much after a while. AA is like a three-legged stool. You got unity and the practice of the principles of the 12 traditions that are designed to push you aside so you can be one of the herd and one with. You've got service, which is designed to proximate an experience with God as it relieves you of the bondage of self, where you become other-centered. And you've got recovery, is the process of clearing away the things between me and people and me and God. And you have all three of those, and they're like a three-legged stool. And we, to stay here long haul, you have to have the stability of all three legs. If you can go for a while with just two and still stay upright, but it's a bit of a balancing act. And if it's only one, it doesn't last very long. You topple pretty quick. So I want to try to get the guys I sponsor taking actions in all three legacies as soon as I can. And some people, there's a resistance in all of this, in all of us, to this stuff. I get it. I mean, I don't throw a guy under the bus because he has a resistance. You didn't throw me under the bus because I have a resistance. But you kept reminding me of the truth. When I would start getting depressed, or I'd start getting things that you'd say things. So, you helped anybody this week? Well, what does that have to do with me? Everything. I tell the guys I sponsor, they'll burn a relationship to the ground. They're a year sober, and they'll go, "Oh my God, it's just hurt so much." I say, "Well, you know, it's really a shame you never finished your 4-step. Probably wouldn't feel as bad." They just glare at you. You know? But I keep nudging them. You know, I keep nudging them. Get commitments, dude. You know, I want a better. My sponsor's idea of Bob and Bob's life is often better than Bob's idea of Bob's life. And my idea and my wish for the people I sponsor is probably better than their wish for themselves. That's why I will always keep pushing them down the road. Can you explain how we never get enough love by others loving us, but by us loving others, to help us push the love out of ourselves? I heard you talk about that on a CD. There was a psychiatrist in Vegas who, if he was still sober, if he's still alive, he would probably have 60 years. Yes, you'd have 60 years probably, or more, probably a little over 60 years. If he's still alive, he might be dead. I don't know. His name was Dr. Dave. And Dr. Dave moved, when I was about a year sober, moved to, to Las Vegas to be the psychiatrist for the state prison system. That they had two prisons outside of Vegas, Gene and Indian Springs. And he used to come to meetings I went to, and Dave used to talk about alcoholism as being a love disorder. And I, at first when he said it, I didn't get it. Then the more he talked about it, the more I thought about it, the more I thought he was right. That we are driven by a vacancy that appears and seems like it could be filled and eased by acquisition of love. The idea that I would be feel whole and complete if I had the right person loving me the right way, not like the others, but the right way. And some of us, we devote our lives in the search of love, and we never find it. It's always just beyond your fingertips, isn't it? You get close, but you never get there. And isn't it funny that we give up? We go into Alcoholics Anonymous and we start helping others, and you start falling in love with some of the people you help. And you drive home sometimes and late at night, and you got that feeling. And it's a wonderful feeling. It feels kind of like you imagined it would feel like if you ever really had the love of your life loving you the right way. And it didn't come from them loving you. It came from you loving them. That I had it backwards. It really is a love disorder. I'm trying to fill the vacancies up by acquisition when it really comes from... It's not in the getting, it's in the giving. I think that Dave might have been right. What is most important for a couple, husband, wife, both in recovery? How best to help each other? Don't help each other. Step away from your spouse. It should be some sort of robotic electric warning. The minute you start trying to help them, step away from your spouse. Go help somebody else. Don't help your spouse. You're not helping your spouse. We know what you're doing. You're helping yourself, aren't you? Yeah. Just get them straightened out. You'd be better. I know. I know. I get it. Try the traditions. Traditions in relationships. Anytime there's more than one person involved, the traditions are powerful. Common welfare should come first. That's like ahead of you. Yes. Put these principles before your personality. That doesn't even seem fair, does it? No. Service work balancing. Service work and commitments. Being there for family and taking care of the wreckage I've created at home. Oh, service work commitments versus being there for family. You know, being responsible, a responsible father, a responsible businessman, a responsible mate, is part of practicing these principles in all our affairs. The book often says that there's a better demonstration of these behind closed doors at home. And that's true. You can't compartmentalize your life. You can't be a fount of service and over here in AA and be a creep at home. You got to be the same servant both all places. But you can't replace 12-step work with family, and I'll tell you why. I must help outside my own sphere of self-interest. And you can, and here's the illusion that your ego will say, wow, I'm helping my wife or husband. I'm helping my kids. And that's great. That's what a responsible member of AA does. But that is not 12-step work. You know why? Because of the pronoun, you're helping. I'm helping my wife, my kids, my business, my help, my house. I'm really helping me. And real the real spiritual uplift comes from pure altruism, and that is helping with no return directly. The return comes from God. So you're not, there's no self, in real service, there is no self-serving. It's other-centered. I started a prayer several years ago, and I really like doing this. My prayer life shifted a little over 10 years ago. I've been doing certain exercises and certain rote prayers for years. And here's my experience. You say that, take the third step prayer, or the prayer of St. Francis for that matter. And you say them every single day. After a couple years, they're meaningless. And I wanted to have a more intimate relationship with God. And one day I realized, what am I doing here? If I want to have an intimate friendship or relationship with someone, I don't do it by doing a drive-by and chanting a paragraph, a rehearsed paragraph at them, and then go on. You know, I mean, what am I doing here? If you want to have an intimate relationship with someone, you got to open yourself up and have conversation with them. And my prayer life started shifting from the rote, memorized, set prayers, which are good. And I'm not saying they're not good. They're good. And I still use some of them from time to time, but I also, my prayers become very conversational. I started talking to God about how I had a desire for a servant's heart. And I started asking that if it be his will, I'd like to have a servant's heart. And the reason that I wanted to do that is that I've been pretty good for a long time with taking the actions of a servant. But the truth is, sometimes I do it begrudgingly. Sometimes there's other things I'd rather do. I'd rather go out on a date. I'd rather go with my buddies. I'd rather go on this trip. I don't want to go talk somewhere. I could be going scuba diving with my guys. But I'll take the actions of a servant that says yes to what's put in front of him. But I'd like my insides to match my outside. So I will continue to take the actions of a servant, but I'd like to have a servant's heart. I'd like to be all the way in, because I think I would rather do it like that. And most of the time today, I do it because I get it. I get the joy that comes from trying to help people and forgetting yourself, the freedom that comes from self-forgetting. That's real true freedom is in self-forgetting. I get it, and I desire to be more on board with that inside me as well as outside me. One more, let's see. Oh, I love this question. It's blank. But I know what you really mean. Oh, there's one more at the bottom. Okay. How did Graham become so humble? God can't even answer that. I'm an idiot. How long should a person be abstinent from alcohol before taking the steps and working with other drunks? I think you should be out of detox probably. Right away. Right. How long do you want to wait to start feeling better and being better and getting better? I think it's dangerous. I hear stuff and I got a sad, sad voicemail yesterday from a guy who a week ago is trying to take his own life. And I was very harsh with him. And I did what it says in working with others. I dwelled on the hopeless condition he's in. He's gonna die. And he has a sponsor. I said, do you have a sponsor? He said, yeah, I got a good sponsor. What's he telling you? He says, oh, he's telling me to take medication because that'd be easier to deal with. So I just hammered him a little more with the truth about me and what I believed alcoholism was. And he said, you know, I've done the medication before. A lot of times I keep relapsing. He said, would you work with me? I said, I'd be delighted.
Yay.
I'd be delighted. I said, I gave him a couple things to do. And I said, I will see you Monday night. I want you to have a coat and tie on. A coat and tie? I want you to be a greeter. What does it say about coat and tie in the big book? I said, doesn't. But if you're not going to do a simple thing like that, what makes me think you're going to do the hard stuff, the heavy lifting in step 8 and 9? Let's I'm trying to see, do you have any willingness or are you still full of yourself? Show me. I'm from Missouri. I want you to show me. You say you're willing. I want you to show me. Show up. Put a coat and tie on. All right, I'll be there. And I got a voicemail from him last night. He thought his sponsor's idea of medication was better, and he went back to him. Maybe it is. I hope it is. I hope this works for him. But in the pit of my stomach, I had a terrible, terrible feeling. And I don't need to be right here. I don't need to be right. I just don't want him to die. I hope I'm wrong. I'd be very, very happy and delighted to be wrong here. I really would. But my gut has a bad feeling about this. But we'll see. Time will tell. And I got a couple minutes to talk about singleness of purpose. Singleness of purpose is under fire today. And it's... Clancy said something to me the other day, actually about 2 months ago. It scared me. And I understood what he said. I've had the same feeling. He said for some time he's believed that the power in Alcoholics Anonymous would sustain us, that we would survive, we'd be here for the alcoholics yet to come. And he told me a couple months ago, he said, I'm not so sure anymore. He says, I'm seeing a massive deterioration in our basic principles being demonstrated through the fellowship. And he said, He said, it's the first time in almost 55 years that I was ever worried that we might not survive another generation. And it's all about singleness and purpose. You know, there's certain countries and certain areas where singleness of purpose is not only not respected, it's disrespected and talked very negatively about. If you even bring it up, people will rant and rave and yell at you. You're going to kill people with that kind of stuff. And they don't understand singleness of purpose at all. The great power that Alcoholics Anonymous has to bear comes with singleness of purpose. What we do here is like a laser. If you take a laser, you're focusing a beam of light so tightly and so in such a small area that it'll cut through a steel girder. But if you spread it out to encompass a large enough area, you get to a point where you can't even read a newspaper by it. Singleness of purpose is not designed to keep anybody out of AA. It's designed to keep AA safe for the alcoholics. Without singleness of purpose, we don't have singleness of solution and we don't have singleness of problem. And consequently, Alcoholics Anonymous could easily, if we open the door to everybody here, you know, I have a problem with alcohol. But you had a problem with cocaine. Well, it's kind of the same thing. But you don't have a phenomenon of craving with alcohol. No, I can take it or leave it alone. But I can't. Cocaine's killing me. Oh, coming into AA. Hey, you have a problem with alcohol? No, I never drank alcohol. But I got a problem with pornography. And it's kind of the same thing, isn't it? It's sort of an obsession. Oh, yeah, but you can drink. I don't drink much. I don't like it, but I could. Oh, come into AA. It's kind of the same thing. Oh, I got an eating disorder. I can't stop. I'm 100 pounds overweight. It's killing me. Oh, we don't want you to die. Come on into Alcoholics Anonymous. But you can drink. Well, I won't, though. I have respect for AA. And we eventually would create a fellowship where maybe a third or a half of us could drink safely. And sometimes would. There's four men in Las Vegas that are dying, will probably never get back to the Alcoholics Anonymous program because they had a sponsor who wasn't an alcoholic. And they got to watch their sponsor return to drinking, and he really wasn't an alcoholic. He had a problem with cocaine. And he'll be able to drink for the rest of his life and have one or two, or leave a half a drink on the table because he's busy doing other stuff. He really does not have an alcoholic reaction to alcohol. And when he went back to drinking, I remember I was at his wedding. He was given him and his bride, who was not in the program, was given a very, very expensive bottle of champagne, a Dom Perignon, I think rosé, very expensive, several hundred dollars. And him and his bride together drank less than half of it and let the rest of it go flat. And we found out that he'd been having one or two drinks occasionally for several months. And all his sponsees got to see that. And AA just became phony to them. They could never trust us again. And they all went out, all four of them, and they can't come back because they don't believe us. They don't trust us. See, he didn't do any of that out of malice. He's not trying to kill those guys. He didn't know that he represented something here. He represented a safe place that was not safe because he could do something that we can't do. What would happen to us if we had a fourth of our fellowship or a third of our fellowship like that? I was down in Tucson. It was early October 2008, because it was a couple weeks before my 30th AA birthday. And I was doing a workshop down there on the 12 steps. And the first session I was going to start that evening at 7 o'clock was on the doctor's opinion and the phenomenon of craving. And before I started, a woman came up to me, a nice elderly woman with gray hair, in her 70s, I suppose, and she showed me a 30-year chip. And I said, that's great. You know, if I make it to the end of the month, I'll get one of those. I said, that's really cool. She had a whole row of women she sponsored there in that meeting, all newcomers, lost-looking gals, kind of. New, you know, like new people are lost-looking a lot. I do the workshop on the phenomenon of craving. She came up to me afterwards, and she says, you know, I don't have that thing you're talking about. And I didn't know what she meant. I said, what do you mean? She said that allergic reaction to alcohol, that phenomenon of craving. I said, well, I mean, you know, it tricks you. You think some of us have it and don't know we have it because we think it's our idea that's spurned from the craving. We don't realize that that's the allergic reaction to alcohol. And besides, you haven't had a drink for 30 years. Maybe you just don't remember that cause and effect in your life. You haven't had a drink for 30 years, for God's sakes. And she goes like this. And she says, well, actually, I have a drink once in a while. And she saw the reaction on my face. And she goes, but I don't get drunk. I just have one, maybe. That's it. One, two, once in a while. That's it. I don't get drunk. I said, are you kidding me? She said, no, I don't get drunk. Did it feel bad taking a 30-year chip? Well, I haven't been drunk in 30 years. I said, but you can drink. She said, well, I don't have that thing you're talking about, but I have alcoholism. I identify with the emotions. And I asked her some questions of what happened is 30 years prior. She came into the program with her husband, who really was an alcoholic, and he asked her to go to Al-Anon, and she found it boring. The laughter was in the other room. And she came to an AA meeting. She liked AA. Well, my God, it's full of her drug of choice. Of course she liked Alcoholics Anonymous. Of course she did. That's like a sex addict running a harem. I mean, Jesus. Of course she liked Elka. And she identified with the emotions, because a lot of people would share things and say, well, I feel like that, and concluded through the identification with the feelings that she was alcoholic. There's in the word alcoholic, there's an implication about alcohol. I know it's a stretch, but there is, really. I mean, you know. And I didn't know what, I told her, I said, you can't do, you've got to tell these gals, you got to tell all these people. I don't know if she ever did. I think she might have. What are they going to think, these women that she sponsors, that they find out that their sponsor's been having a drink or two a couple times a year for 30 years? That shakes the credibility of Alcoholics Anonymous to its core. So singleness of purpose isn't designed to keep you out. We don't care if you're a heroin addict. We don't care if you're a cocaine addict. We don't care if you shoot meth. We don't care if you gamble. We don't care if you watch pornography on the internet till you end up in the burn unit. We don't care what you do. But you gotta have alcoholism. Because if you don't, then you're gonna make this an unsafe place for us. You can have everything else, but you gotta have this. And singleness of purpose. We will not survive. There's a lot of churches now. I think there's three or four of them around the country, and they're chains kind of. And they've started, they were jealous of the success of Alcoholics Anonymous, but we weren't Jesus enough for them. And we won't be, because it's not that we don't want to be, we just have to respect our traditions. Because we have to have this, a Jewish person has to feel as welcome here as a Muslim, as a Buddhist, as a Hindu, as an atheist, as a Christian. We do not segregate. We do not push anybody away. This is we do not affiliate. Well, they wanted affiliation. And so they've all created their own little 12-step agendized things. And they're well-intentioned. These people have good hearts. I've had conversations with some of them. They are well-intentioned people who want to help God's kids, and they are solid in their own faith. They're missing the point. They've twisted the steps around a little bit to agendize to their own religious beliefs, and they promote them in groups where all disorders are available. So in Saddleback, in Alcoholics Victorious, and in all these places you'll go, and you'll have compulsive gamblers, and you'll have sex addicts, and you'll have pedophiles, and you'll have cocaine addicts, and you'll have meth, and there's very little recovery there, because they've got the laser opened up and spread over too big of an area, and it has no power. There's no connection that's made there of one alcoholic talking to another. I'd just like a show of hands. Well, you might not. Nobody wants to participate in this. All right. How many people here have had a problem with pills in addition to being alcoholic? I have. Anybody? Okay, so third of the room. How many people had a problem with heroin, shooting heroin, besides alcohol? Not as many. Okay. Well, how many people, cocaine? Oh, okay. How many people, compulsive shopping? Sugar, eating sugar. Not everybody. There's a little groups. There's, getting about a third for some of these things. Now, here's one nobody will admit to. Pornography. Oh, wow. Wow. Don't shake hands with me. I don't know where that hand's been. Just kidding. How many people have had a bad time with alcohol? See the difference? It's our common ground. It is our common... We come together over this. We can have a lot of other problems. That's fine. I don't know. There's very few. I haven't run into you catch a guy whose problem's just alcohol.
Wow.
Pete, would you grew up in a brewery and they wouldn't let you out? I mean, what? That's rare nowadays. But we got to have alcoholism. It's if we don't, I don't think we'll survive much longer. There's a movement in Alcoholics Anonymous to do away with God, or at least to push him back. It's a big atheist movement now coming around. Bill Wilson said he didn't like that. And it's personified in different areas out of ignorance. You know what's happened? You see this all over Europe. You will not hear the Lord's Prayer said in a meeting anywhere. And it's often this sentiment is brought about by people who are offended by the Lord's Prayer as being too Christian. And some of the people that are the backings of this sentiment are because they're from the Jewish faith and they don't want to say the Lord's Prayer because it's too Christian. And instead, let's say Serenity Prayer. Well, this is very silly. First of all, if they were to study historically the nature of the Lord's Prayer, they would find out it's a Hebrew prayer. It predates Christianity. There was a great article in the Grapevine called Judaism and the Lord's Prayer, where a rabbi wrote the article and he traced it back to way before Christ. It's just that Christ liked it. The same reason Bill Wilson liked it. It's one of the few prayers that lines up with the 11th step. We pray only for knowledge of his will. The Serenity Prayer, if you ever read the whole Serenity Prayer, the second verse, it is adamantly Christian. If you were opposing it on the grounds that it was too Christian, the Serenity Prayer, the second verse, talks about Jesus and our sins and damnation. Oh, it's really Christian. And the Serenity Prayer is in direct opposition to the principle in step 11. Pray only for knowledge of his will. Serenity Prayer is not only. It's not thy will be done. You're given, in Serenity Prayer, you're given God instruction. You're telling me, it's a give me prayer. Give me serenity. Give me wisdom. Give me acceptance. You know, you're giving instruction to the creator of the universe. It's in direct opposition. Alcoholics Anonymous is unique in its approach. I occasionally, Sunday mornings, I'll find myself getting ready for a meeting at a convention or doing something, and I'll turn the TV set on, and I'll scroll through some of the religious guys that are on there. And I'll tell you, I don't oppose any of these guys. There's a couple of them I like a lot of the things they say. Olstein, he says some cool stuff once. So there's a couple of them that I really think are cool. I don't get on the muscle about those guys anymore because my whole approach has changed. But they have one thing that they all do. And it's, we don't do it here. They all encourage their flock to pray for their own selfish ends. Pray for abundance. Pray for riches. Pray for success. We don't do that here. We are at a level of humility, if practiced and lived, that I think is much above what they're doing. See, we know that we don't know. We don't ask God to do nothing. If the second commandment has any validation at all about not taking the name of the Lord thy God in vain, and that predates Christianity, that came from the Hebrew and it came into Christianity, then what would be the vainest use of God's name? Wouldn't it be to pray for my will, for my abundance, for my... I mean, could you think of anything vainer than that? To instruct the creator of the universe, you know, who's been doing well for billions of years, but Bob's here now. Hey, God, listen up, will you? Listen up. I mean, is anything vainer than that, really? I don't think there's anything wrong with our... I think there's a danger in people coming in here and trying to change what we do here. I mean, for God's sakes, the people that are trying to change us, it's not like they've had a good track record managing things. Leave AAAA. I have a daughter who's not an alcoholic. in my family tree, alcoholism seems to skip every other generation. My grandparents were alcoholics, my parents weren't. My sister's not. Chances are that my daughter's children, my grandchildren, will be alcoholic if it runs true to form. And if that's the case, I don't want to see my grandkids get to a point where they're in their late teens or early 20s and they've exhausted everything and they're standing on a bridge trying to get up enough courage to kill themselves and in fear walk off that bridge. I hope they walk into a thing called Alcoholics Anonymous. I hope it's here for them, because I know in 1978, if it wouldn't have been for AA, I would have taken my life 30 some years ago and been glad to do it to escape the anguish of the alcoholism. Do you know, in the history of the human race, alcoholism has been predominant. It's been prevalent as far back as you can go historically. There's always been cases of alcoholism. And throughout history, for thousands and thousands of years, there's been massive failed attempts to fix us. I have a book at home called The Slaying of the Dragon, and it's historical attempts to treat alcoholism. And it wasn't that long ago that they did weird things to us. They put us in stockades and poured their garbage and pee pots in our face, hoping to shame us into sobriety. They burnt us alive at the stake at one time. They cut holes in our skulls, believing that there were demons in there, to release the demons. It's not that long ago, just in our life, some of our lifetimes, where they were giving us lobotomies, cutting out the parts of the brain. They did it to Francis Farmer, if you ever saw the movie Francis. They did it to a guy that used to come to AA in Vegas, and they didn't get it all, and he had epileptic seizures until he died with 35 years sober as a result of a partial lobotomy. They gave us electric shock treatments. I'm going over to Russia next summer. I was over there a couple years ago, and I saw something that was phenomenal. There was a man over there, and I don't speak Russian, so we had to use an interpreter, and he came up to me between sessions, and he was very excited to tell me his story. And he said, he told me that one of the last things the Soviet Union did before its collapse to treat this horrific social problem of alcoholism, and it's a big problem in Russia, to this day it is, probably more so per capita than anywhere in the world, except maybe an Indian reservation. That's a bad problem in some of the reservations, especially in New Mexico. And one of the last-ditch efforts, the Soviets had spent billions of dollars, and their scientists had developed a chip. And if you were a chronic offender and you couldn't straighten up, they would surgically implant this chip into the muscle tissue in the middle of your back, and if you drank again, it would detect it, and it would release a toxic poison into your bloodstream that must have been like some super antabuse or something. I mean, sometimes if you weren't in good shape, it could seize you up and kill you, but a lot of times it didn't kill you, it just make you wish you were dead for about 2 days. And as the guy's telling me this through the interpreter, he pulls his shirt up and turns around, and there's this ugly scar in the middle of his back. And he says that after a year of having the chip in there, a year of no relief from his alcoholic emotions, he begged his best friend to take a kitchen knife and cut the chip out of him so he could get relief. Now, that sounds a little bizarre. I'm telling you, I wouldn't have made a year. I'd have been worth the pain of cutting the chip out to go get high, because that's the way I'm wired. And Alcoholics Anonymous, they say that low estimates is there are over 2 million sober people sober over a year in the world today. High estimates are that there might be very well be 4 million of us. There's more sober alcoholics that are free in this room today than there was probably in the whole U.S. 100 years ago. It's the first time. This is a small, small, fragile window of 79 years. In the course of thousands of years, that's nothing. That's nothing. It's almost it's a bare speck on the history of alcoholism. we must protect what we have here. Do you know everything that had to come into order and to line up for us to be here? All the coincidences that had to happen. There's nothing that would make me believe that God, after 4,000 years of not having it happen, would do it again if we screw it up. It took 4,000, better than 4,000 years to line all of that up for us to be here. I think we have to the alcoholics, our grandchildren and great-great-grandchildren and great-great-great-great-grandchildren who might be alcoholic, we have a responsibility to the future that this remains the same. There are meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. I could take you to meetings in Las Vegas today, or you'd go into that meeting and you wouldn't recognize AA there. A friend of mine says, oh, those are AB meetings. I said, what's AB? He says, I don't know, but it's not AA. I'd like to see Alcoholics Anonymous become recognizable against the backdrop of our basic text once again. Thank you all for listening.
All the recordings are available on simpleactions.net. We have other events upcoming. We have a speaker event in January. We're doing a big book study next spring. Watch the website and we'll get flyers out to the AA community as we did. As far as cleaning up, once after we've said the Lord's Prayer, we just really need to put all these chairs up at the back of the room, and that's really the main thing that needs to be done. And I'd just like to once again take the opportunity to thank Bob. And I'd like to also thank all the home group members who showed up and did the food and all that stuff. And I think that's it. So for those that are here to join you, we're going to form, I won't call it a circle, we're going to form whatever that was or last night, and we're going to say the Lord's Prayer. Thank you.
Our Father.
Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom,